This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Hey, Andrew, if you want to be president someday, you got to have a website.
Yeah, I guess I do. I guess you're right.
You got to set the narrative. You got to have a platform. And what better way?
You got to have that spin.
Where else are your spin doctors going to work but on a website? And what better way to do that? By building a website with Squarespace. Squarespace empowers millions with their all-in-one platform where customers can build a site, claim a domain, sell things online, and more. Their product has award-winning design and powerful tools to help you build your brand and launch your ideas into the world, like the primary campaign of a young state senator from Illinois. All sites are designed for mobile, nothing to patch or upgrade, and they've got 24/7 customer support if you need any help. So go to squarespace.com/overdue for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, use the offer code overdue to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Squarespace, yes, you can make a website with Squarespace. It's Overdue, the podcast about the books you've been meaning to read. My name is Craig.
My name is Andrew.
And we have a special guest whose name is...
It's me, Camille.
Hi, it's me, Camille. Welcome back to our show.
It's good to be back. It's been a while.
Yeah. What books have we had you talk about so far?
We talked about the witch book, the
Hex.
Awful witch book.
Hex.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
We talked about, was it Nicholas Sparks was the...
A Walk to Remember, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So some real, a real wide breadth of topics that we consider you an expert on, apparently.
I mean, it seems right. Like sad romance, mm-hmm. witches, and mm-hmm. black presidents. Mm-hmm. I am your girl.
So yes, we are going to be talking about A Promised Land by Barack Hussein Obama. Volume 1, I guess? This jerk has more of this book he wants to write.
I mean, we elected him to be president for 2 terms, so 2 books, I guess. Even though he doesn't get all the way through his first term in this one.
He does not.
He makes it up to like 2011, like early 2011.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about that book. I'm particularly excited to politically yell with y'all. I think me personally, that's why I'm really invested in this conversation. For some good political yelling. I don't think we're going to do a full author section because, as Andrew noted before we hit record, it's Barack Obama, the 44th president of the United States. People may have heard of him. But before we get into that, like, what are y'all's relationships to presidential biographies or presidents? Just how do you feel about them in general?
How do you feel about presidents? I mean, a real mixed bag, I think we could say, presidents.
Sure.
Got some good ones, got some bad ones, got some good ones, did some bad things, got some bad ones, did some good things.
Runs
the gamut.
Yeah, it really does run the gamut. A couple of weeks ago, it was President's Day, and I think that's a really special holiday because I believe it's the only holiday that we have in the United States where we openly celebrate war criminals. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really brave of us, actually. As a nation, with the exception of Jimmy Carter. He's our only non-war criminal president. But that's a conversation for another podcast.
Funny that
do we count Christopher Columbus? Is he just a regular criminal?
Hmm.
Oh, yeah, I guess. Well, he's fallen out of favor. He's slowly but surely being canceled by the liberals, the liberal elites of America.
So. Philadelphia's got a statue in a box.
It's true. We just left it there. We didn't even take it away. It's still in a box. Suck it, Chris. Well, interesting that you say that Jimmy Carter is a war criminal, and by many, he's regarded as one of our least effective presidents. So that's something to consider. Who is making those judgments?
Really makes
you
think.
He got a bad rap.
Yeah.
He got a bad rap.
It does make you think.
It's Iran's fault. That's my
Have any of you ever read one of these before? I wanted to do something like this because I have never read a book like this before. I don't think I've ever read a president's autobiography. If I've ever read about presidents, it's probably been in the context of like a history class.
Yeah, like I don't read many autobiographies in the first place. I don't know if that's just because I expect somebody's autobiography to be mostly about like PR and image management rather than about like insight or scholarship. Now, that's unfair, and I don't think that totally tracks with everything that's in this book, but I guess I do. I mean, not everything.
Yeah.
But I guess I do view like a third party who goes out and does other interviews and research to be the more like holistic, authoritative record of somebody's life and activities at the end of the day.
Sure. I buy that.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. Camille? I mean, so I love memoir, but chiefly I focus on the real heavy stuff, your celebrity memoirs. If you sure. haven't had a chance to listen to Angelica Houston's memoir, wow, are you missing out, truly. But I mean, I always feel like when I see a political kind of autobiography on the shelf, I want to have read it, but I don't want to read it, if that makes sense. I have started and not completed many a tome of this type.
Well, that gets to our podcast, which if you've never listened to it before and you've been confused for the last few minutes, is that we're gonna read a book for you essentially and talk about it, and then you can either disagree with us having read it already, or you can look forward to making a choice about whether or not to read this book based on what we say for the next hour or so. It's usually how it goes. I want to get to this presidential memoir thing, but let's just quick review the facts. I got a quick little bio sketch of Barry here. I did go to obamawhitehouse.archives.gov, and there's a page that is from his second term that's still up. That's like, he's currently the president. You can wish him well by emailing this address or... like tweeting at POTUS, which is not true anymore.
This is not a conversation we're going to have on this podcast, but I am fascinated by the digital side of these transitions because the old website really truly does just get boxed up and put in the back of some server somewhere so the new website can go up. And sometimes that's good, like when the 1776 report disappears from the internet suddenly. But mostly it's just odd. Like, you can still go see the Clinton website just fully intact now, much in the way that you could go see the Space Jam website for a while. Maybe you still can, but it's one of the few like websites that's just stayed totally unchanged by like web 2.0 or anything modern. And it's strange to see.
But our 44th president, born 1961 in Honolulu, he was an Illinois state senator from...
Are you sure?
Oh, I guess we'll talk about it. He was an Illinois state senator from 1997 to 2004. He gave that big old keynote speech at the DNC in 2004, ran for U.S. Senate, served in the Senate for a few years, but he was too busy running for U.S. president, which he won, and served in that office from 2009 to 2017. If you want to learn more about him, you can read his books. You can watch the movie Barry or South Side with You or The Final Year or Change or a bunch of movies that people have made. And those that I do not sign off on those other movies because they're made by people like Dinesh D'Souza. And I would never tell you to watch those movies. He studied at Columbia. He was a community organizer. He was the first black president of the Harvard Law Review when he was studying at Harvard. He taught at U Chicago Law School. And some stuff he did in his presidency include the ACA, Dodd-Frank, recovery from the Great Recession. We'll talk about his Nobel Peace Prize, because there's a bunch of other stuff he did that was not very peaceful that we consider.
Boy, you're really droning on about this guy's achievements.
Yeah.
Craig.
I'm just, you know, I deported them to another part of the podcast is what I did.
Whoops.
His books include Dreams from My Father, published in 1995, a book I have not read. Audacity of Hope, 2006, a book I have not read. But and in my own dreams, I am not a father. In my own dreams, I was wondering if we'd talk about this, one of those for the show, but Andrew, you kind of pushed back on me, and this book seemed to be the smarter choice, I think.
Well, just because it's the, and I've read some reviews of this that have talked about how dramatically different these three books are because they're written by a much different person, which with much different goals. Like, I figured The Audacity of Hope, where we learn about a man gearing up to run for president, wouldn't be that interesting. And then maybe Dreams for My Father would, like, we could talk more about him as a person, but it's still like a pretty dated photograph, I think. I would assume, I guess.
It was his biography before he was even in the state Senate. So.
Yeah. And I just assume we would be constantly trying to shift the conversation away from talking about like things that happened during his presidency anyway. So this one seemed like the easier thing to talk for an hour about.
Sure.
To me, anyway.
There's a guy who's written a book called Author in Chief, Craig Furman. Shout out to Craig. It's hard out there for a Craig. He's written a bunch of... He's written a history of presidential books.
The mic doesn't pick up your eye roll.
Well, what I was going to say was jail for you, but in an abolitionist way, of course.
Yes. There, justice should be served at the very least. And Furman, in an interview with Smithsonian, he talks about a lot of other books. Oh, yeah. So he talks about this book being like it's the longest any president has taken to publish a memoir, 3 years and 10 months from their last day in office in the modern sense. Other presidents in the before times, before the internet, really, what I mean before World War II, they took longer sometimes. But Abe Lincoln apparently had a best-selling book based on his Lincoln Douglas debates, where he just stole a bunch of newspaper transcripts and turned it into a book, and a bunch of people bought it. apparently, after the Civil War, there was a big boom in these sorts of things because everyone wanted to learn about Grant, and Grant had lost a bunch of money in a pyramid scheme, and also he was dying, and everyone was like, "Can you finish up and write your biography, George R. R. Martin?
Wrap it up.
Let's go." But Calvin Coolidge is apparently the first one who was like, hey, I'm going to write a book about what it feels like to be president. And that kind of set that seems like a thread of this book. It's so strange to be the leader of the free world, this title that I bestowed on myself. So that's interesting. And then another guy, David Greenberg at Rutgers, I think referred to, his first book, The Dreams from My Father, a genuine book, a genuine memoir. The thing about Audacity of Hope is it's really a lousy book. It's a standard campaign book. We see these all the time. And I think that's kind of the modern sense of this as a mix of presidential memoir that is before you run, where it's your campaign stump speech rendered down into a memoir. Or it's your, I was the president and I'm here to set the record straight and tell you what it was really like.
Those pre-presidential books, and they all have titles like Praise for a Flag or like
Strength of a Nation or something.
Like, yeah. I would Venmo either of you $5 right now if you can remember without looking it up, whatever Kamala Harris's pre-presidential book was named. Because I got nothing.
Truly have nothing. I will say, I do have like a faint memory of having read The Audacity of Hope, because it was on so many lists and it felt like something that one should read.
Yeah.
And clearly it just went through me like Taco Bell, because I have no memory of that book. And that doesn't mean it wasn't good, but I don't know. As I think we're all sort of alluding to, I think your average reader is right to be suspicious of these kinds of books that have such an obvious agenda. It's like, do I trust you as a narrator of your own life? I don't trust myself as a narrator of my own life. So I don't know why I would trust a president more than I trust myself.
Kamala's book is called The Truths We Hold. I've already forgotten.
We probably hold them in jail because they were late for school.
Jesus.
Sorry. The thing to note about this book that we're talking about today is that Obama wrote it himself. Like, a lot of other presidents have used ghostwriters. LBJ, Ronald Reagan used ghostwriters. Clinton had a speechwriter interview him, and then he wrote his book based off the transcripts of those interviews. That book was 1,000 pages long.
Yeah, no, that sounds like a Billy Clinton move to me.
And Obama wanted this book to be a single volume 500 pager, and he just couldn't. He just couldn't bring himself to do it.
Too much spicy context that he just needed to share with the people.
Yeah.
Well, this line from the Vox review of the book really grabbed me as to why it is so long and it absolutely didn't have to be. Quote, Obama relitigates every public relations battle he ever fought down to the time he said Hillary Clinton was, quote, likable enough.
Yeah.
During the Democratic presidential primaries. If you're going to get down to that level of, listen, let me tell you what actually I was doing with this, then yes, you're going to have 2 700-page books.
There's a pretty expansive interview with Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic with Obama about this whole thing. And he says, what I'm trying to accomplish in this book is both history and a story. And he goes on to say, like, if he was just writing a narrative, he might have left out all the cap and trade stuff. And if he were just providing a chronicle of event, then he wouldn't be making sure that chapters ended on cliffhangers. Which I'm not. Are there cliffhangers in this book?
I mean, only if you.
Maybe. Okay.
I guess. Sure. Like, technically, yes.
But in another way, no. Like, extremely no.
Can I have cliffhangers for, like, things that happened when I was alive, like, 9 years ago, and that I definitely remember all of? if that's the case, then yes, there are cliffhangers abound.
Okay. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and talk about how we want to talk about this book, and then we'll talk about it.
Craig, I love having a president, but you know what I love even more?
Saving money?
Yeah, and also shopping online.
Yes,
we all shop online. Everybody does it. And you know when you shop online and you see that little promo code field just saying, hey, you could save money if you knew how, idiot. Well, guess what's going to help you? It's another sponsor of our show this week, Honey. Honey is the free browser extension that scours the internet for promo codes and applies the best one it finds to your cart. So what you're going to do is you're going to install the browser extension. You're going to sign in. You're going to start shopping on one of your favorite sites. And when you check out, you just click the little button and it says apply coupons and it does the thing. It applies a coupon. And if it finds a coupon, you will watch those prices go down in real time. I saved $3 on packing tape because I needed to pack up boxes and send them out of my house.
That's a good deal.
It's a pretty good deal on packing tape. It was a 6-pack.
Wow. And yeah. We all are sending things all the time now. That's a
yeah,
good
I know.
Okay.
So Honey has found its over 17 million members, over $2 billion in savings. If you don't already have Honey, you could be straight up missing out on free savings. Don't you hate it when you pay money for savings? That means you're doing it wrong. Honey is literally free and installs in a few seconds. And by getting it, you'll be doing yourself a solid and supporting Overdue. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/overdue. That's joinhoney.com/overdue. Save some money, give it to us.
All right, welcome back, everyone. We're going to talk about this book, A Promised Land, now. Let's set the stage for who is an expert on this book and who is not. So, okay. I read parts 2, 5, and 7. When I read part 5, I listened to Barry tell it to me himself. It was an enjoyable but also predictably Obama-ish experience. It was actually kind of interesting, and I will probably go back and finish the other parts. But I did not have to read all of it because each of you read all of it for
yes,
me.
Correct.
Thank
yes,
you.
Yes,
I read the whole thing with my eyeballs.
Okay.
And I listened to the whole thing with my earballs. Mm-hmm.
How long did it take?
A casual 33 hours or so. It took some time.
I want to say mine took closer to like 9 or 10, but that doesn't count. Because sometimes when I read before I go to bed, I will read the same page like 5 times before I admit to myself, hey, you're falling asleep. Just go to sleep, idiot. Mm-hmm. So there was probably an hour or so I burned doing that too.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. Where do y'all want to start with this thing? What's on your brains in how this book works, how it feels, how it operates?
What do you think, Camille?
I mean, did we want to talk about the function of these kinds of books from the start, or do we want to work our way up to that?
We can start there.
Yeah, let's start there.
Well, I mean, so I went into this book assuming that it would mostly be reputation laundering and a kind of controlling of his image and kind of asserting his power and asserting policy now that he's no longer in the role. And this book did not disappoint on any front. I do feel like we got a lot of like, yes, I made this decision. And yes, it was challenging. But like, here's why, baby. Like, you know, there is a lot of that. And I think that's part of why the book is so needlessly discursive. I mean, the other reason for it is Barack Obama simply is who he is. The man is not succinct.
Yeah. It's not succinct. But not in like a free-ranging sort of Clinton-y sort of way. It's more like a, let me explain to you not just what I did, but also what everybody else thought I might have done and why they were incorrect to think the way that they did.
But also, I'm not just going to tell you. I'm going to be very kind of writerly and like what I think of as literary in my writing style. There were some moments where I was just like, Barry, you're getting a little carried away.
There's some similes in here.
He's a voracious reader. Like he has always been someone who fancies himself like a student not only of history but also of literature. And like the opportunity to sit down and make some presidential literature seems to have really enticed him. He also says at one point, I don't remember if it's in the prologue or in another section, he says of himself, if every argument had 2 sides, I usually came up with 4, which is just every issue is like a panopticon of choices that he has to name before he can move on.
Yeah, that's a pretty sick self-burn.
I was expecting it to be the sort of reputation laundering and like getting out in front of like historians and posterity in terms of like defining his legacy. And I guess just giving people like future scholars a starting point when like talking about his legacy. Like, here's what the guy who did it thought about it. So on that front, fine, whatever. I don't know how much other presidential books traffic in this sort of thing, but I was sort of surprised by how defensive most of this felt to me. Particularly like defensive from like defending it from the left.
Yeah.
This is about a cap and trade bill that he ultimately didn't end up putting together because he decided to give Lindsey Graham the job of chasing down the Republican votes that would get it through the Senate. Ooh, that didn't work out for him. But he says, my happy talk about a painless shift to a carbon-free future prompted grumbling from some climate change activists. They hope to hear me issue a call for bigger sacrifice and harder choices, including a moratorium or outright ban on oil and gas drilling in order to confront an existential threat. In a perfectly rational world, that might have made sense. In the actual and highly irrational world of American politics, my staff and I were pretty sure that having me paint doomsday scenarios was a bad electoral strategy. And so not only do we not get any self-reflection on the fact that he did this the way he did it and then also lost a bunch of politics after, but it's very like that happens a lot is like these activists said I should have gone farther and I see their point. But in the end, I was right to do what I did. And I feel like he does that even more than he engages with like the Republican argument, possibly because he views the argument from the left like coming from a place of like better faith, or because he figures those people will be more likely to read his book than like a Republican base voter.
Yeah.
I don't know, but it feels very like the whole book feels kind of written from a defensive crouch to me, even as he is crowing about some stuff like the Bin Laden raid and the Affordable Care Act and Dodd-Frank and some of the other stuff that you mentioned, Craig. But it's very legacy protecting, but also very defensive.
Something you guys were saying before the break, one of the, I think in the Smithsonian article that I found on A Brief History of Presidential Memoirs, one researcher referred to these books as they're not the last word, but they're an important word, which I think is what you were getting at, Camille, is that like this is him putting his stamp on what he thinks happened. But obviously we can go out and fact check it and we can compare it to things that happened then and have happened since. The other thing that I was struck by in the passages I read was like, how different does this book feel if he's writing it during a Hillary Clinton presidency versus a Donald Trump presidency? How does it comes out after the election of 2020, like the actual election day? So there's just a lot of the, I don't know, the prologue has stuff in it from, you know, when it was published and when it was written here in 2020 or last year in 2020. Geez. So like, I feel like some of that defensiveness and some of what he's talking about and the way he talks about Republicans is obviously very colored by the fact that Hillary Clinton did not win. And so his legacy is immediately changed just by virtue of the other party coming in and undoing half of the stuff he did or trying to.
Yeah. And he also gives us some kind of very ominous foreshadowing a future that we all lived through. So, but it's kind of started for me around like Sarah Palin, and they're like, who the hell is a Sarah Palin person? And then it's like, oh, and this would be a sign of things to come.
Yep.
Dramatic pause. And like, I get that, but there's also a way in which I feel like very impatient with it. I felt actually deeply impatient and frustrated for a majority of this book. I think largely because I am the left that he is addressing. There was a moment in the book where he described himself as left of center. And I said, who's left? Who's center? Two very real questions I have. But it was super interesting to get a sense of his perception of himself, like what he thinks his foibles are and what his foibles actually are. And he definitely like sees himself, as you were sort of saying, Andrew, someone who's like pragmatic and realistic. And he credits his grandmother like with that sensibility, which I thought was interesting. That he
Toot.
Yeah, Toot. Grandmama Toot. And he says, you know, you know, she's why I felt compelled to disregard overly broad claims about the need to tear things up and remake society from whole cloth. And it's just
because
like
she was a like a classic American dream bootstrap, like worked hard and got by and then died story. Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And I think we can hit that theme again, Camille, as we go through some of the specific sections we want to talk about. I just also want to toss out this thesis statement of the book that he put in the book and is also in a couple interviews where he says, more than anyone, this book is for those young people, an invitation to once again remake the world and to bring about through hard work, determination, and a big dose of imagination, an America that finally aligns with all that is best in us. And he's given a less like super, you know, dreamy version of that quote in interviews where he talks about like he wants to let people know that like geopolitics is just high school cliques, but everybody's in charge of a country. And so if you've survived going through high school, you could get into politics and also like change the world if you want to, which is just, I don't know that I found this book inspiring in the sections that I read. But I don't know, I can wrap my brain around, even if I don't necessarily fully agree with it, the idea that it's like, this is attempting to say, you could come in here and do this, I guess.
I mean, I will start by saying that definitely I can see Bibi Netanyahu as like a mean girl.
Yeah.
That's definitely a a role that that man could play.
Well, and he compares Putin to like a Chicago ward boss. And so I think when he says that, he's like, that, yeah, if you've dealt with local politics and you want to work hard enough to like get involved, moving for, you know, moving up the ladder, like you can do that. The same relationships work. It's just the stakes are higher. Which I don't know if that's empirically a true statement. I can see why he thinks that because he did that.
Yeah, one of 45 people like ever to have done that. Yeah, I also don't find this book inspiring. There were moments where I saw like a glimmer of something good, but there were many more moments where I was just like, God, this is frustrating. Like that it takes this many pages for you to give me a rationale for like why you did this thing that impacted so many people's lives. Like, so for all of the like common sense, like folksy things that he tries to traffic in, I don't know. There's just this real tension there, right? If you talk about, you know, wanting to encourage people and inspire them and simplify things in that way, but then talk about how like, well, actually you can't just remake something. Like that's getting a little wild. Like there's an inherent tension
to that. That is frustrating.
Yeah. And I agree that I didn't find this super inspiring because he's got a lot of self-doubt. And I think that comes from being able to see every side of every argument. Is like, I made the decision and I was right to make the decision, but I can see where everybody else is coming from to a point that maybe feels a little like self-defeating. But it's the message I got from the book in a lot of places is like, you know, that feeling that you're too small and too powerless to make a change in the world that means anything. And everything is just kind of happening and it's happening so fast and your power is so limited. Well, bad news. Like you can be president and still feel like that all the time.
Yeah. That does feel like a thing he was really trying to communicate is that all the problems that you face in your life also afflict presidents. And like, I don't know if that makes me feel better or worse or what that makes me feel, but I do think that he successfully communicates that idea. To what end, I'm not sure.
Yeah, the only moments on the inspiration front that I liked were the couple of times where he credited somebody for like going out on a limb to make a call that he thought was risky. Like there is one section where they're trying to pass some version of the Dream Act, which for people who don't know what that is, it's a various versions of it have been like proposed over the last couple of decades, but at its root is the idea that kids who were brought here, brought to America as kids who had like no say in it, who often didn't even know that they weren't citizens until they went to apply for college or a passport or something, like they should, because they've been Americans their entire lives and they've paid taxes and they have lived here and they don't know the country that you would deport them to if you were to deport them. Those people should have a way to stay here and optimally like a path to citizenship. Fine. You can see why in the modern Republican Party, that would not be a thing that they would want to do. And so that's why it hasn't gotten done. But he was talking about trying to get that bill passed through the Senate and talking to a senator from Missouri, Claire McCaskill, who is a Democrat, but is from a state that was red at the time and has gotten redder since. And she said, you know, if I'm going to be the vote that gets this over the edge, I will be a yes. But otherwise, I am going to have to, you know, be pragmatic and vote no if it doesn't make a difference, because that's what I have to take home to the people who are going to reelect me. And at the end of the day, it doesn't get enough votes, but he looks at the roll and sees her name in the yes column. And she said, you know, when it came down to it, I thought about those kids and I had to vote yes. And I don't love Claire McCaskill for a few reasons, but that I didn't know about her, and that I thought was like to highlight moments in American politics of like genuine bravery. That feels like a thing worth doing that doesn't happen a lot.
Yeah. Sure.
And so I like that. There were a couple times that happened.
He does I don't know if there are any that come to mind that stand out to you, Camille, like that one does for Andrew, but he does lean on that device of like, hey, can I take two paragraphs and tell you about this person and that thing they did? and like why I think they're cool. Like, I was struck by the Samantha Power. He clearly, like, he loves Samantha Power and thinks that she's amazing. He does that for a couple of his staffers. I mean, he could go on for ages about Reggie Love. I could use a whole book about him, about Reggie.
Yeah, I mean, I think he has tremendous love for his staff and the people mm-hmm. who helped him through every day of his campaign and his, you know, his role in the Senate and his presidency. Like, that comes through very clearly. And but there is this like boys club thing that permeates really the entire book and his entire staff, obviously. Yeah. And it is interesting to see like who he says, you know, they're a little bit of a rascal, but mostly they're a good guy. It's like who gets that description and who just gets to be like unscrupulous, which is literally how he describes Lindsey Graham. Which is amazing. And actually, I actually want to talk about this. One of the highlights for me is just listening to Caddy Obama just like dunk on people.
He does. Yeah.
That's one thing I missed, I guess, when I was just reading it. Like some of it comes through in the words.
Oh my God.
But I would like to hear him talk about how Lindsey Graham was like, what did he say? Like he's the guy in a heist movie who wants to double cross everybody or whatever.
Listen, I have the quote. We deserve the full quote.
Please.
On Lindsey Graham, please. Short in stature, with a puggish face and a gentle southern drawl that in an instant could flip from warm to menacing. He was also smart, charming, sarcastic, unscrupulous, media savvy, and thanks partly to his genuine adoration of John McCain, occasionally willing to stray from conservative orthodoxy. Now,
I love that string of adjectives. Can you just read those for me again?
Smart.
The one that just like is a bunch of vaguely positive sounding ones, but then unscrupulous right in the middle of it.
But it was one of those things where I was like, oh, you had me in the first half, and then you get to the second half. Yeah, he has dozens of these. And I do recommend listening to the book. It also feels important to note that he does like voices and he does accents.
Who's he talking to? Is it Ban Ki-moon?
Someone of East Asian descent.
I believe it's Ban Ki-moon. And he's talking about the climate stuff. And trying to get the like a second Kyoto agreement or something. And it's just not great, Barry. It's not a full accent. It's just he changes his voice enough in a way that's uncomfortable to listen to.
Yeah, the first time he did it, I sat up straight in my bed and said, "Sir, excuse me? Do you know this is a book for sale for everyone? Like, you can't just do that." I mean, for me, the one that put it really over the top was I think there was like some issue with like the interpreter for like the Chinese premiere at some summit somewhere.
Oh, he just calls that guy so boring.
So wild. And I'm just like, Barry, who's your accent coach? That's number one. Two, who asked for that? Who told you to do that? You could just say the words.
Very uncomf. I love when he introduces Putin and he says, and this, again, he's dunking on people, where Putin welcomed us for the obligatory photo op. Physically, he was unremarkable. Short and compact, a wrestler's build with thin, sandy hair, a prominent nose, and pale, watchful eyes. And you're like, he loves saying the word unremarkable. He did that in one take because he'd been saving that up for a decade.
And he also knows, guess who is definitely 100% going to listen to this?
Oh, yeah.
Is Vladimir Putin.
In general, this is like a stylistic thing for the whole book, it seems, is that he loves these little two or three sentence character sketches that are a list of those Lindsey Graham adjectives and like, some kind of Dickensian like face portraiture that he's doing where he's like, I need to give you a mental image of this person.
Yeah, like she had a face like a peach pit or whatever it was. That's one. I don't remember who that is about. But.
In the campaign, in part two is the whole campaign. I do want to make sure we do like a soup to nuts, just like what is the book. But in the campaign, he talks about the woman who he just like spent
the whole time in Iowa trying to make laugh and couldn't. And it's like, okay, I guess she doesn't find you funny, Barack. Like, it's cool, bud. She was good at her job. You became president.
Yeah, I just, can I share one more?
Please.
Like, dunk. Oh, that's
absolutely.
Really good.
Share as many as you want.
So the Mitch McConnell one.
God, Mitch.
It's delicious. Barack writes, he showed no aptitude for schmoozing, backslapping, or rousing oratory. As far as anyone could tell, he had no close friends, even in his own caucus. But what McConnell lacked in charisma or interest in policy, he more than made up for in discipline, shrewdness, and shamelessness, all of which he employed in the single-minded and dispassionate pursuit of power.
The thing about that one is I think I could see Putin or Lindsey Graham getting a little mad about theirs, but McConnell would read that and be like, yeah, he's got a point.
That's right.
He's
like, that's
facts
right.
All day. All that's day facts.
That's exactly correct. That's me.
The former president has a point.
He's got a good,
that's my Mitch McConnell
he's
impression.
Got a point.
It's very good.
The filibuster.
So yeah, there is fun in Obama the character sketch artist.
Yes, there is.
And
there is.
And what to me is interesting is, like, I don't know. So he never kept consistent presidential diaries, which is actually what took him a while to write the book, is because he didn't have that like tome. Like that in my brain, I remember from Veep, because it's like a whole plot point in Veep. But like, he doesn't have that, like, we wrote down my entire schedule and I have feelings about it. So like, where is he pulling all of this imagery from? Like, he has his, like, I don't know, like maybe he's just scrolling through his Facebook feed, like, and then just writing down what people make him feel when he has to describe them.
He's got, in the acknowledgments in the back of the book, he's got like two paragraphs of people who he talked to.
Oh, that's a good point.
To like back up his own observations as well. So I think there's some of that.
Camille, what, just like run us down the scope of this book. That we're several feelings into this episode, and I feel like I want to make sure we at least let the people know like what they might find if they crack this book open.
Yeah. So it starts with his first campaign kind of in Illinois, right?
Okay.
Takes him through the senatorial campaign. And then making the speech at the DNC, and then goes through the 2008 presidential campaign, and then up until the killing of Osama bin Laden. Like,
okay.
That's where we go in the book.
And that's kind of the one thing that we get from 2011. Like, in terms of domestic politics, like if you're reading this to read about the dynamic between him and Republicans after the Republicans retook Congress, like, you, the only thing that moves past the 2010 midterms is the bin Laden stuff, I think. Like,
there's some of the Arab Spring stuff carries over, I think. Some of the Arab Spring stuff carries over a little
bit.
Yes,
yeah. Some of the like foreign policy stuff, but as far as domestic stuff, like, he gets to the midterms and how bad they feel and how he feels like ultimately he did make all the right choices, but he just didn't do a good enough job telling people about it, which I don't honestly disagree with. At least not the second part. But yeah, like, he doesn't get into any stuff with it. There's no description of John Boehner in here, and I'm interested to see what that is in the next book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what are some of the things he hits? So he hits, you mentioned Andrew, the Dream Act. He talks about the work on climate that ultimately was like, okay. He talks about the climate thing is so weird. Can I just say the climate stuff where he's like, well, we didn't even really have a good agreement, but I did need to get China on board. And me and Hillary Clinton were running around Copenhagen like it was a heist movie. And we burst into a meeting and I yelled at the guy from China. And then he signed this crappy agreement. And then I had to get on a plane right away. What I do like about the climate section is it opens with, I don't remember which of his daughters, Sasha or Malia, is like, hey, are you going to do something about those tigers?
About the tiger thing. Yeah, that was Malia.
That was Malia. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I guess I do.
my daughters do know that I have a responsibility to this planet. And then it closes on him flying home in a freak snowstorm while Michelle's like, hey, did you do anything about those tigers?
Oh my gosh, I can't believe it's taken us this long to talk about Michelle.
Yeah.
Although, wait, maybe we shouldn't get in.
What, this book Andrew? Made me really want to read Michelle's book, actually.
Wait, so say more about that. Say more about that, because I have read that book and I didn't adore it, but I'm curious.
Well, I mean, maybe it's not a good, but I don't know. Like, she, and I think Obama has always done this. Like, he always builds her up to be the one who can just like cut through everything, and she has all these insights, and she kind of hates politics, which makes her an ideal person to talk about everything that's wrong with politics. I don't know, she's just consistently like funny and sort of along for the ride in a I don't know, like a cynical sort of way that I vibed with a little bit, but I don't know what her book is about. So
I did appreciate the parts where he would be doing something important and he'd be like, yeah, Michelle was at dinner with friends somewhere. And I like that, A, because she just was able to get away. Like, really, I was just really happy for her every time he said that she was just not involved.
Well, she could not have been more clear about her disinterest in being a political wife.
Truly,
she was really not down for that at all.
Yeah,
like isn't there? I think it was. Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say I don't remember if it was the state senate or the U.S. Senate race where she was the last person that he ran it by, and that's a very like, you know, mom's gonna say no, so you ask dad first sort of way to go about this.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he does that to her often. It's just wild. Like, imagine one of your spouses being so vehemently opposed to something like super major and then just doing it anyway. Imagine.
Oh, I buy a lot of computer parts without asking.
All of the problems that afflict normal people also afflict presidents. It's the promised land. It's the promise in this land.
That's the land.
But I do feel like there's a moment where he's like, you know, if you don't want me to do it, I won't do it. And she's like, great, you're not doing it then. And I forget what moment, like where that comes in, but it, like, they have so many of those conversations. And you really do walk away from this book feeling like, man, Michelle really puts up with a lot.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Well, really, yeah, I guess that's why I want to read her book. It's like, I know it too will be an extremely polished PR exercise in its own way, but I would like to know what her side of this was like, if that exists in written form anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Sure. What are other things that get covered in the book that y'all want to make sure we hit on?
I mean, the financial crisis feels like just something to name.
Yeah.
That happens.
I don't think I've sat and read. I feel like maybe I've personally just avoided reading a lot about the financial crisis. And I don't think I'd fully unpacked why I did that until I was reading parts about the financial crisis. And it really got to me. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a challenging section. One of the things that Obama always spends a lot of time doing in this book is explaining his staffing choices. And when he talks about the appointments of Larry Summers and Tim Geithner, he does it at such length. and he really like keeps coming back to it. And, you know, he's like, yeah, I know Larry Summers said all this stuff and has all this baggage, but he's the right man for the job. And I'm just like, you know, I have questions. I have a couple of suggestions. Yeah, it was just kind of surreal to listen to that.
But it's okay, Andrew, Camille. He balanced it out by talking about the time that Larry Summers fell asleep in China while they were at a opera or something. Like, it's cool. He's correcting the record. It's fine.
I do. The one thing what I really liked about Larry Summers in this book is it gave me a lot more appreciation for right now, where Larry Summers is all alone on a little island saying that the stimulus is going to be too big and nobody's listening to him.
Well, and that gets to me is like, that's a larger thing of the exercise of reading this book here in February 2021, is just like, just as it would have been a different book if he'd written it under a Clinton presidency, it is a different book to read in the garbage fire of the last 12 months in particular. That makes all of those like, here's all the reasons why I did the best I could. And I was really good at doing the best I could, even if it wasn't enough. Like that, it stung more, I think, knowing how dire things are now. And I just don't know that that's avoidable for folks reading it, unless they are folks who don't think things are dire. What are you doing? Something about the financial crisis section, Camille, that stood out to me. There's a section where he's talking about just the economy that led up to the crash and how, like, I guess, like, I don't know, he's talking about the internet for a sentence or two, and then he's just talking about how, like, I don't know, the economy's out of control. In this new winner-take-all economy, those controlling capital or possessing specialized high-demand skills, whether tech entrepreneurs, hedge fund managers, LeBron James, or Jerry Seinfeld, could leverage their assets, market globally, and amass more wealth than any group in human history.
What's the deal with hedge funds? They're not hedges. They're not funds.
LeBron in here dunking on Silicon Valley, making all the money that no one else can. It's such a bizarre... I just wrote, what is this? Next to that
It's
passage.
A weird list. It's a strange list of things.
I just couldn't handle the numbers in that section.
It's a stone cold bummer.
Yeah.
Well, stone cold bummer. What you get in the financial crisis section of things that made me the most upset is that you got voices like disgraced former mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel.
Yeah.
A man who is not an economist, who, as far as I know, is his, like, the thing he's best at is saying to Democrats, don't do that. But he has, like, no relevant financial knowledge. And he says, you know, I don't want to see a financial stimulus package with a T in front of it, meaning that it can't cost over $1 trillion, because he views that as, like, politically untenable. And Obama relays that anecdote, and then it just, like, kind of sits there, and that's what they proceed from. And I think that's one of the things that makes me the most upset about the Obama administration in general, was its tendency to, like, not just to roll over to Republicans, but to roll over to Republicans after they'd already, like, compromised with the imaginary Republicans who live in all their heads about whatever this bill must look like to pass and to not alienate a wide swath of the country, I guess.
Yeah. I had a lot of those feelings as I read about the Jeremiah Wright stuff.
Oh, sure.
I was really curious about, like, how he thought of that and how he...
Can you, like, set that up for a quick second, Camille?
Oh, yeah, sure. So Jeremiah Wright was the pastor of this church. I think it's called, like, Trinity Church or something like that in Chicago, the Obama's church. They didn't go super often. They went, like, once a month or something like that. And Jeremiah Wright is this kind of fiery, social justice-y kind of a preacher, I would say. And he, you know, there was a scandal where some excerpts of his sermons got released, and Obama had to respond to them. Now, the things that upset people about the Jeremiah Wright sermons were, like, he had all these comments about America being racist at its core, and that, you know, like, the U.S. government is, like, behind the AIDS epidemic. I think the big quote was that, you know, not God bless America, goddamn America. And everyone was, like, clutching their pearls about that. But the thing about Jeremiah Wright is that he didn't actually say anything incorrect in my eyes. Now, he did have some praise of Louis Farrakhan. I think that's, like, kind of the worst piece of it.
I agree.
But in terms of saying that, like, America's racist at its core, it's like, that's, I mean, I don't really see that that's up for debate.
Yeah, do we not? Is that all? It was is that not, like, pretty uncontroversial?
Yeah. At this point, as a lefty person here in 2021, like, reading those words was like,
that's what he was saying? Like, that's what people were mad about?
Right. Like people were so mad about it.
Like, mad enough that Obama had to condemn him as opposed to the man who had been at Barack and Michelle's wedding.
Yeah.
Like, had to condemn him and write him out of his life in a speech to make his primary campaign functional again, or perceived to be functional again. And to like read those words.
Was that the primary or was that the general? I guess it was the
primary. It was around the PA primary, which is so late that it never matters.
Yes. Sure, yes.
I fully agree with you, Camille. My experience reading it was like this. Yeah, I hear. There are a lot of people talking about that right now. And there were a lot of people talking about that right back then. Like, it's not.
Yeah, and it seems like he is really still kind of committed to that position. Like, he seems to really think that Wright said some things that were boneheaded. And I'm like, I think he said maybe one thing that was boneheaded. I don't think he said things, plural, that were boneheaded. And he did just cut him out of his life. And he talks about how kind of emotional that was and how sad he felt and how guilty he felt. But I'm just like, yeah, dude, but you did it anyway. Like, that's so ruthless. And I feel like that's another kind of frustration that I have with Obama as he conceives of himself in this book. He's like, I am the reluctant president. Like, I'm doing all of these things that must be done, not because I want to do them, but because they must be done. And it's just like, but like Barack, like.
Yeah, my takeaway from that those passages in the campaign section were like, a presidency and a presidential campaign just warps people, and it warps your relationship to people, and people get caught up in the grinder that is that. And like, this is the Jeremiah Wright section is like a perfect little portrait of that process from beginning to end. And yeah, he says he felt genuine remorse knowing this was all because of his association with me. And I don't think that there's a way to like wipe, you know, just go, whoop, okay, thanks for saying that, and then move on. There's a truth to be taken out of that about just what it means to run for president in this country and the costs that come from that, and how people other than just you, the president, for whom this is all so strange, other people bear those costs.
Yeah.
I think, the frustrating thing about it is like about that and about pretty much everything he says in this book is this is a man who will never run for any office ever again. He literally never has to care what any voter thinks about anything that he does or says for the rest of his
life. That's a good point.
And he, I mean, to your point about brain warping, Craig, like some of the stuff that he has done because it is politically expedient, he is not willing to. He doesn't say that's why he did it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he disavows Reverend Wright because he said boneheaded things or whatever. He doesn't say that he did it because he needed to win the primary, which would be a more like honest assessment, I think, of why he ended up doing what he did, which was to give this big landmark race speech. And
that is how he phrases
it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's how his like speechwriters talked about it. The PodSafe people make jokes about how they would say, okay, now we need to do a race speech, but about like the deficit, like in reference to how like well that speech was received and how well it achieved what their like stated goal was, which was to make people think about stuff, but also to make the problem go away, I guess.
Yeah. It's trying to do both of those things.
Race comes up in this book he himself is really reluctant to attribute any of the stuff that he experiences as president to race. Like, he's often willing to admit that might be like a component of it, but I think this was true when he was president as well, like maybe thinking about swing voters or whatever, is like, they don't want to be called racist, so I'm still not gonna call them racist. Does that like track with what either of you?
Yeah.
I feel like one of the only things he comes out and says, this is definitely racist, is when he gets into some of the birtherism stuff at the end of the book.
Yeah. Well, and he also, there's like a moment where they're talking about like, you know, the person who calls him the N-word, you know, like the angry protester or whatever. And it's like, there's this palpable like fear of like attaching himself to the race conversation. Like, I think it would be really interesting for Barack Obama to talk about how he wasn't allowed to raise his voice for 8 years. Like, mm-hmm. like that's interesting. And I think there's a way to talk about that that is honest, that doesn't have to be like, I don't know, like it doesn't have to be the entire corpus of his book. I can understand why he wouldn't want to do that, but it yeah. does feel like he gives race, you know, very short shrift, if any shrift at all, in this book. And now maybe it's coming in part two, but it's just weird. And even like how he talks about his background, it's all couched in this like multiculturalism stuff that I find tiresome.
Well, and he sort of talks about feeling a little divorced, I guess, maybe from.
He does talk about that, yeah.
His own race and his own experiences with like a racist system, maybe because he was able to, like, he ended up being able to like go to good schools and succeed in politics. Like, maybe he didn't feel it as acutely as like as a typical person would, but it attributes to that like holding it at arm's length thing.
Yeah,
I think.
There's a review of it in the Times. There were a couple of reviews in the Times, actually, but the one from Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, she said, when he's talking about the Gates incident, the beer summit stuff, her words on it were, he argues that the police overreacted in arresting Gates, just as the professor overreacted to their arrival at his home, which feels like the kind of facile, equating... Yeah. That is usually the forte of the racially naive. Both sides were bad, as though both sides are equal in power.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that kind of sums that up.
And like what? The most charitable reading of it, the most charitable reading of it is he sees himself as a president representing every American. And so he has to approach that entire enterprise with this like complicated generosity that does not close people off from that. But like, it's very clear that that is just not the reality of how people perceived him. And yeah, Andrew, I in the sections that I was reading, I didn't get the sense that he was ready to reckon with that. Obviously, like, this book ends in 2011, so we haven't gotten to Ferguson and Black Lives Matter and mm-hmm. what he might say about that, but I don't know what he will or won't.
Yeah, I mean, you say he, you know, he sort of sees himself as trying to be president of everybody, and that's right, but I don't think we can overlook that he also is a president who's going to be running for a re-election, and the way, like, that
that's
section, like the beer summit section of the book is capped with, we lost a lot of white voters that day and we never got them back. Like, that was kind of the ultimate upshot from that entire thing.
Yeah,
which I think says something about maybe where his mind was.
Yeah, that's fair.
Not to say that he was wrong to be thinking about that, but it's another section where I feel like he's not talking as like openly or honestly about like his experience of being like the first black president, like emphasizing the black part as he might have been. I don't know.
May I offer an unrelated rant?
Absolutely.
Please.
So I wanted to talk about like gender relations on his staff.
Go for it.
I found myself hyper attuned to it. And there is this section where he talks about, you know, some issues were brought to him in terms of how some of his male senior staff were creating, you know, a toxic workplace, essentially, and creating some really problematic norms in the White House.
Rahm Emanuel is swearing at everybody. And Obama's like, are people not okay with this?
Basically, that is the section. And so what Obama does is he has a 2-hour dinner with like a dozen women on his staff. And he tries to get to the root of it. So I have a quote here. He says, "And while many of the women expressed appreciation for the degree to which I actively solicited their views during meetings and said they didn't doubt, my respect for their work, their stories forced me to look in the mirror and ask myself how much my own inclination towards machismo, my tolerance for a certain towel-snapping atmosphere in meetings, the enjoyment I took in a good verbal jousting, may have contributed to their discomfort. Now, that is such a bucket of nonsense.
I really appreciate you dancing around the explicit tag that we may or may not need to put on this episode. We've done a pretty good job so far.
I'm really trying.
Wow.
Like, let's unpack this here. So the issues that we are talking about, the things that are happening in this workplace are Rahm Emanuel.
Like, just as an issue, he's there.
He's an issue. And also this overwhelmingly male team, right? Swearing and, you know, talking trash and screaming at people in meetings. Like, all of those things are just unprofessional. Like,
just being dudes, man. I don't know what the problem is.
Well, and so that's how he thinks of it. He doesn't think, like, there's actually no place for that in the workplace. And some of his response to his senior female staff is to coach them to be more assertive, which I find frustrating. Like, and it's also strange when, like, the only really visible senior person on your team is Valerie Jarrett, who is, like, your very close friend. It's like, okay, so we can't all be Valerie.
Yeah.
So, like, what I need you to do as my manager is to make sure that your deputies aren't, like, dropping F-bombs and screaming at people and making them cry in meetings. Like, that's just, you know, and there's like little things like this that I was hyper attuned to through the book. When he's describing Alyssa Mastromonaco, he describes her as baby-faced, and he says that her baby face belied her unmatched talent for troubleshooting and organizing events, because that's all Alyssa Mastromonaco brings to the team. Like, that's not what he said, but, like, that's kind of what he said. Whereas in the same paragraph, Jon Favreau, who's 23 at the time that he starts working for Barack, gets to be thoughtful and good looking. Like, that kind of description is annoying. Like,
yeah.
And there's no.
I mean, I also personally was a little annoyed every time he was like, "Hey, Pod Save America fans, I know you're here. Let me just take
just come on.
Yeah, let's
in.
Talk about
four
fabs.
Lines
let's
just
talk
to
about
describe
fabs.
This guy that you're all here to hear me talk about." Yeah.
Yeah, and I just found it frustrating. And that's all she wrote about it. Like, he doesn't come back to it. It's just like, yeah, and I tried to be better. I don't know how I did.
Well, and then, like, later doesn't Valerie Jarrett say, yeah, I guess, like, people are complaining a little less, so mission accomplished, I suppose.
He does, there is kind of a, it's funny, there is a kind of mission accomplished vibe to a lot of things where the mission wasn't really accomplished. Like, he's like, we did our dang gone best a lot, and we were pretty good at it. And then he moves on to something else that he didn't get to finish, because there was lots of obstruction and lots of problems and lots of reasons why he couldn't accomplish everything he wanted to do, but god dang, he was really good at it.
Yeah
But, like, Camille, I got, and it's not that he doesn't do this with the men in the book too sometimes, but every time he would introduce a new, like, woman cast member in this, like,
they are introduced all as cast members,
like, he did that with Alyssa Mastromonaco. He does that with Samantha Power. Like, every time he would describe some woman's, like, physical appearance, it made me uncomfortable. And he does, like, to balance it out with talking about how, like, Larry Summers kind of was a slob. Like, fine, I get that you're trying to be, like, writerly and to create for me in my head a sense of what this person looks like. But I feel like that kind of ignores the way that the, like, how women look is scrutinized in politics, and just, like, maybe don't do it for anybody.
Yeah. Although I will say,
I mean, these are also real people. I can just, like, Google image search. You don't need to tell me what you think they look like.
True. But his description of Larry Summers was viscerally disgusting in a way that I found really satisfying.
Sure.
Well, and he's also, like, he's not insightful about qualities of people. So like,
yeah,
give me the Lindsey Graham list for all the people you want to talk about. Like, that's cool. Run on that.
Yeah, just don't talk about the way that their skull is shaped. Like, I don't need that part of this.
But
But I did laugh aloud when he talked about Ted Kennedy having a huge head.
To your point, I'm glad you brought that up, Camille, because I've been sitting on this quote from the Jeffrey Goldberg interview about Trump. And so when he gets into that last section, he does talk about the White House Correspondents' Dinner and the Trump thing and the birtherism and the birth certificate and all that stuff. And Goldberg asks him about, like, if he saw Trump coming, essentially, which is like a weird premise for a question anyway. But Trump is not... Trump, Obama noted, is not exactly an exemplar of traditional American manhood. Quote, I think about the classic male hero in American culture when you and I were growing up, he's saying to Jeffrey, the John Waynes, the Gary Coopers, the Jimmy Stewarts, the Clint Eastwoods. There was a code, the code of masculinity that I grew up with that harkens back to the 30s and 40s before that. So even if there's a notion that a man is true to his word, that he takes responsibility, that he doesn't complain, that he isn't a bully. In fact, he defends the vulnerable against bullies. So even if you are someone who is annoyed by wokeness and political correctness and wants men to be men again and is tired about everyone complaining about the patriarchy, I thought that the model wouldn't be Richie Rich, the complaining, lying, doesn't take responsibility for anything type of figure. And when you were talking about the workplace atmosphere and the all that stuff, I was just struck by, like, the other bucket of men he dumped on the table when Jeffrey Goldberg was like, can we talk about manhood and Trump for a second? And it's just an interesting generational set of reference points that he has for that kind of thing. And I don't think his point is entirely off base. I think there are a lot of people that Trump is inherently a hypocritical figure for a lot of reasons in every element of his existence. So I think that's a valid critique there, but I don't know that he was just like, let's talk about John Wayne and Gary Cooper, I guess.
I do like the thing about John, like a John Wayne movie, but John Wayne is just like complaining about how everybody's got it out for him the whole time and that this guy, you know, he drew his gun first, but really I would have drawn my gun first if like the sun hadn't been my eyes.
Is there anything in the foreign policy stuff that you wanted to touch on, Andrew? I know that you had mentioned that. I was kind of just struck by the structure of the whole Iran nuclear deal section. Like, that was a way for him to talk about how the United Nations works, his relationships to Russia, his relationships to China. And it was all run through it. Like, it had a through line of, like, we got to get this nuclear deal done. Like, that was Obama, like, what if I wrote a spy novel about my presidency?
Yeah, like, I don't think he talked about fully about the nuclear deal stuff. I think he set the stage for it because that was a second term
thing. Yeah.
I think he's more interested in relaying the foreign policy stuff.
Yeah.
At least in this book. Like, he talks about the domestic stuff, but
it's what he has more control over, right?
Well, you said this to me when we were talking about it, but like most of the back, like 2/3 or like back half of the book is foreign policy stuff.
Yeah.
Which feels distorted to me because I think American politics is really like throughout Obama's presidency and especially now has gotten like more inward looking and foreign policy has gotten less important in terms of like winning elections. So the extent to which he went on about that stuff was a little like surprising, honestly.
Well,
I don't know.
I mean, not to be crude, but I think he gets off on it, honestly.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. He loves it. He thinks it's fascinating.
Yeah, he's super into it. And he had so much fun talking about like the Chinese intelligence officers and like how brazen they were and how like someone went back to their hotel room when they were in China and there were just like three very obvious Chinese intelligence agents just like rifling through papers on the desk.
Yeah.
Like that, he was psyched to tell that story.
Well, and that's the stuff that is uniquely the experience of the president.
Yeah.
Like the domestic policy stuff, to your point, Andrew, he stops talking about it after they lose the midterms. And there's not as much domestic policy that he could actually talk about accomplishing. And so he moves on to
here's the climate thing I did. Here's the Iran stuff that I was working on. Here's the time I killed Osama bin Laden personally. I was there. I was sitting in a folding chair instead of the chair that a man offered me because I was so psyched to watch it happen on TV. And he's just like, yeah, he does. He's very interested in it. It also, like, he's very interested in other cultures. He's interested in their history. He really just, like, I think he really wishes he could have been pals with Medvedev forever. Like, he loves Medvedev and thinks, man, if only I could have just partied with that dude, we'd be in a better place.
I mean, that's kind of how I feel about Medvedev. Yeah. Like, what if he had actual power? Like, maybe we'd be somewhere.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, to Obama's credit, I feel like he wants to write about disingenuous arguments with Republicans about the debt ceiling about as much as I want to read about them. So I do completely get why he would background the domestic stuff and talk more about foreign policy.
Yeah, and it's also a thing that he can say is, like, distinctly different from certainly his predecessor as he's, like, working on it. Like, he's like, my job was to go around and clean up all the messes that the Bush administration had made. Let me talk about the messes that I couldn't extricate myself from because reasons.
Even though he does talk about how rude it was that on the way to his inauguration, there were people protesting.
He does say that.
Bush. He does. He is.
Yeah.
Like, couldn't they let this man have, like, be at peace
towards the top of the
with the war crimes that he did?
Towards the top of the show, Camille, you were bemoaning some lack of self-awareness on specific issues, and that pulled my ear because one of the things he says when he praises certain, like, opposition figures in the book, like McCain and Bush, is he either says that they had a self-awareness or that they're self-effacing. Like, he prizes that in people even when he disagrees with them, like, they're from another party or politics or something. Like, when he's talking about working with the different folks in the Chinese government, like, when he meets the economic advisor and he's like, this guy at least seems to know what's going on. Like, he can crack a joke. He seems to value that. Even when he's like, yeah, everything you did sucked, but at least you can put on a wry smile about how much it sucked.
Because he does value a towel snapping sort of camaraderie in his meetings.
Like, so. I know that all of the internet was quoting, like, the ethereal bisexual thing, but I think the whole towel snapping, I think that's 10 times worse. Like, honestly, yeah. I really do.
You know what
hideously
I think
embarrassing.
Is also pretty worse is the cringe, corny cringe part where he's talking about getting ready for his debate with McCain. And he says, ultimately, it was rap that got my head in the right place. Two songs especially. Jay-Z's My First Song and Eminem's Lose Yourself. Both were about defying the odds and putting it all on the line. Parentheses. Look, if you had one shot or one opportunity to seize everything you ever wanted in one moment, would you capture it or just let it slip? How it felt to spin something out of nothing, getting on by wit, hustle, and fear disguised as bravado. Listen, Obama, I am a doofus, and I have ever performed that song live in front of other people.
That was the first time I ever saw Craig. First time I ever saw Craig. He was at an open mic doing Lose Yourself.
Listen, I like that song, and I do enjoy it. But Mr. President.
Camille. I'm like coming out of my skin. I like, suppressed the memory of that passage because it was so mortifying.
I'm in this picture, and I don't like it, Mr. President.
Just like in, like, a black sedan on his way to a very important debate, telling himself that he only has one shot and one opportunity. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Like, that song had been written about him.
And of course, all I see in my head is, like, the Chappelle show. Yes. The Chappelle show.
Spaghetti.
Spaghetti.
So that was, like, I have a list of just, like, observations and theses about this book, and one of them is observations just corny. He's just corny. He's a corny guy.
He's
okay,
a corny boy.
So, galaxy brain take. This is why I feel like these playlists that drops, those are not his playlists. Mama's not cool enough. He is a man of simple tastes and simple pleasures. He wants to listen to Lose Yourself. He's not out here listening to Nipsey Hussle. Be serious. honestly.
Thank you for that, Camille. We should start to wrap. I want to make sure.
But like, should we do Eminem? Like, what kind of rap do you want to?
My name's Craig Getting, and I am here to say.
Mm-hmm. You want to get to the end of this podcast in a major way?
In a minor way, I think.
A minor way. Yeah. Okay, cool. People don't sing enough in raps about like the small things that they want to do. Like, I want to fold this laundry in a minor way. It doesn't have to be great, but it does have to fit in the drawer.
My name's Craig Getting, and I'm here to say I'm washing this bowl in a relaxing way.
Mm-hmm.
Because I do dishes sometimes to relax.
Mm-hmm.
Those are
this
the facts.
Is a hate crime. In that I hated it.
I do just like, I want to hold space for the fact. How do y'all feel he handled the... It was wild that I got the Nobel Peace Prize because here's a bunch of non-peaceful stuff I did.
I thought this was, I mean, in a book full of self-aware moments, I think this was pretty self-aware. His reaction to getting the Nobel Peace Prize was pretty much what all his critics' reaction.
Yeah. Okay.
Which is correct. Was.
And, this is I think one of the perfect Michelle Obama stories in the book is he gets the call. She is like, who's on the phone? He said, oh, it was whoever gives out the Nobel Peace Prize. I got the Nobel Peace Prize. And she's like, that's nice. And she rolls over and goes back to sleep.
Cause one of the experiences of reading the book is like to get a clearer timeline of things, of just when things were happening contemporaneously. And I do think he takes pains to be like, here's why it was weird for me to get the Nobel Peace Prize here when I was talking about the surge and I was, you know, gearing up for these other things that I was doing that certainly involved a lot of military and a lot of killing people. So yeah, that is some self-aware stuff. I don't know. You're making a nodding face, Camille. I don't know if you have any other thoughts on the Peace Prize.
I do not.
Okay. And my last question for you two, Obama was asked about writing this book. Did he come away, like, was there anything he didn't know about his presidency until he wrote the book? And he said, I have to say that when I came to the end of the book and I looked back, my views on my presidency were surprisingly consistent, which, A, weird flex. Did y'all find anything that we haven't talked about particularly novel or otherwise illuminating about your own feelings about Obama's presidency or where we find ourselves here today? I came away with more of a like, wow, it's weird that the president could just call up another president who's in trouble and be like, listen, here's how you're going to resign, dude. Like that, when he's talking to, I think it's Mubarak, and he's like, hey, damn, your people are mad at you. I know I've only been president for a minute, but here's what's going to happen. It's like the U.S. presidency is a weird, terrible thing is what my feeling was. How about you guys?
What do you think, Camille? Are you waiting on me to go or do you want to go?
You could go. You could go.
This was mostly as I remembered it, I think, from living through it. And I think my main, in comparison to the Trump presidency, where the PR strategy was to constantly say that you did great stuff that you never actually did.
Sure.
I think the takeaway about the first half of Obama's first term, where he was just like not willing to do the politicking part of the job. He was not willing to do as much to sell stuff as he needed to, or he was just not good enough at it because he wanted to cover like the nuances too much instead of just saying, I'm going to give you money to get you out of the recession. I think that his conclusions on that are pretty much what my conclusions are, which was that the recession was tough, but a lot of those early problems that you had were a PR problem, and you did a bad job at them, maybe because of hubris or because you thought that the country's like post-Bush like divorce from the Republican Party was going to last longer. I don't know what it was, but yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. That was my, that's my thought on the question that you asked.
Sure.
Does that answer your question?
I think so. I'm not sure. Well, you came away with the answer that he had, which is your views on his presidency were surprisingly consistent.
My views on his presidency were surprisingly consistent, which were, was that the parts that made me, that I expected to be mad about, I was definitely mad about.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah. That resonates. That resonates. I think all of my frustrations with Obama and his presidency are the same frustrations that I had, you know, walking in. I think they have slightly more texture. But I should couch, you know, my hour plus of criticism of this book by saying, you know, I am exceptionally cynical. And was very cynical in my reading of it. It was interesting, certainly. Again, I think the most valuable thing was just getting a sense of how he thinks of himself. Like,
yeah. If you're not, okay, thought exercise. If you're someone coming to this book with a little less cynicism, like, what might you be getting out of it? Is it like, oh, that's what he was doing? I don't know. Because I kept running aground on the like, why didn't you act on that feeling you had? Or why didn't you push further with that impulse? Where maybe folks who were like, great job, bud, are going to be like, oh, look at him doing a good job. I don't know if that's going to be their experience of this book.
Yeah, I mean, I think the conversations around how a White House runs and how like a White House staff is created, like I thought that was actually like very illuminating.
Sure.
And just kind of pulling back the curtain on some of that and on a lot of those conversations. Again, like with memoir, it's like hard to know. It's like, did he really say exactly that to you? That doesn't seem quite right. But
some of his longer conversations with his daughters are like, who was transcribing that? Who wrote that down? How do you know you
not
said
Michelle.
That?
Not Michelle.
Obama's having his own woke toddler moment in the middle of his book. And then Malia turned to me and she said, Ruth Conda forever. I think that if you are not as like politically engaged, or if you know like the, I don't know, the results of the Obama presidency, but not necessarily how it got made or like the process that made it, I think you can read this book and say like, dang, that's a hard job. The thing that happens a lot in the second half of the book is that he constantly has to actually hop back in time. Because if he said everything chronologically as it happened, it would be impossible to follow because there are like 900 things all happening at once.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And so, you know, he talks about passing the Affordable Care Act, and then he talks about like Arab Spring and like the midterms, and you only get a sense like in the middle of all these stories, like, oh hey, these were all happening in like the same 4 month period.
You have to, that was a juggle for me of like, how old is his presidency at this, whatever particular paragraph I'm reading.
Mm-hmm.
And also because he's prone to tangents, he's talking about Putin and he just goes, since the time of the czars. And he just starts talking about historical Russian cultural behavior for a page. You're like, Jesus, were you president or not when this thing you're saying happened? I need
no,
to know.
He can't help himself, and it's simultaneously like deeply annoying, but also like kind of endearing. Like he is very professorial, and
listening to it, it's like he's teaching a class on his own presidency.
Yeah, it's a great listen. I had a really enjoyable time just washing the dishes, whatever, doing homework, just listening to the smooth sounds of Barack Obama in my ear balls.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do we think he accomplished what he set out to do?
To write the first half of a book? Yeah, sure. He did a great job.
With whatever he wanted this book to accomplish, based on what we think the book is trying to do. That'll be my final question.
I mean, he certainly explains why he thinks he was right to act as he did most of the time.
Sure.
Yeah.
He definitely does that.
On the inspiring the young thing,
yeah,
I'm less certain about that.
Yeah.
I'm less
yeah.
certain about that. Yeah. But, you know, we would need someone young to tell us how it hit them.
Yeah. And I don't know if the through line of here's how strange it was for my family helps someone who might be sitting in with those feelings also. Because he does take pains to include those when possible. And at their best, they're painting a portrait of what it is to like go through this bizarre experience with young kids and stuff like that.
Camille, you can say whether you agree with me on this. I think for some of the same reasons that his like sort of asking Michelle for stuff and then going ahead and doing whatever he wanted to do anyway, some of the family stuff rings just a little hollow to me. Like I can buy that you would be sad about your kids growing up while you were president, but also you had these kids already when you decided that you definitely needed to be president of the United States.
Yeah.
I mean, I get sad when my baby outgrows a pair of pants that I thought were cute. So, like, I get that it hits you in weird ways that you weren't expecting it to hit you. But, yeah, I don't know.
There's definitely, like, a West Wingification of his own life, I think, that happens. Like,
sure.
When he's talking about playing ping pong with the chef, whose name escapes me, it's just like, okay, like we get it, like you weren't a regular boss, you were a fun boss. Like there's like there's like a lot of that, and over the course of like 800 pages it just like wears on you and
sure.
you become so aware of the performativity of it. But to answer your original question, Craig, like I feel like I have a good sense of who Obama thinks he is, who he wants to be, and how those things are sometimes the same and sometimes different.
Yeah, sure. And I don't think it wrestles really well at all, or even tries to, with Obama the celebrity. I think he pretty much eschews that, even though maybe that's a thing that's more a second-term thing in his brain. I don't know that that's true. I think that's really wrapped up in why you might enjoy reading about the campaign if you read it, like because Obama became a cultural icon as much as he became a president. The Obamas both of them.
Yeah, I mean, I that feels more like a retrospective sort of end of book two.
Maybe.
Thing. Maybe. Like, I'm curious to see in the second book, like, does he wrestle with this? He personally was extremely, extremely popular, but many of the, like, positions and policies he espoused got the party that he belonged to like
just shellacked,
just completely wrecked in every election that he wasn't on the ticket for. So like, how do you square those things? Like his own personal popularity with his inability to confer that on any other person or idea in American politics.
And he's reticent to explicitly talk about the racist stuff other than the Trump birtherism stuff. So yeah, maybe he'll go into more of that in Promised Land 2, Presidential Boogaloo.
Stupid idiot.
I don't know. It was fun. I had fun.
I enjoyed myself mostly.
Yeah.
I had fun talking about it too. Like, I think, you know, we all lived through these 8 years together. Why not read about it and then joke on it for a little while?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, pretty tight.
You can't Lindsey take that Graham. Back. You set it into a microphone.
I regret every choice that led me to that moment.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Sure. Well, thanks for...
Well, what you really need, in the spirit of the book, I think what you need to do is you need to... Mm. Explain all of your different options before you said that.
Oh, and there were many.
Explain to us why you were right to say the thing that you said in the end.
I appreciate the parts where he was like, here are all the reasons why I didn't need to tackle a particular issue. I did it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That's some of my favorite parts of the book. Anyway, Camille, thank you so much for joining us and talking about this promised book.
Thank you for having me in the promised land.
What if folks haven't figured it out by now, where else should people check out you and your thoughts and your jokes and your japes?
If you want to hear more of my thoughts and jokes and japes, you can catch me on the Unfriendly Black Hotties podcast, which I co-host with friend of the pod, Christina Tucker. So you can listen to Unfriendly Black Hotties wherever free podcasts are given away again for free. You can follow me on Twitter. I am at that Blasian girl.
Cool. Thanks. If folks want to tell us what they thought about Larry Summers falling asleep in China, they can email us at overduepod@gmail.com. Hit us up on Twitter and Facebook at overduepod. Thanks to folks who reached out in the past week, including Christina, Dave, Hannah, Monica, Bronwyn, Kate, Layla, Amy, Christine, Beck, Anthony, Danielle, Catherine, Maggie. Camille was dancing, so I had to stay on beat.
I liked it.
Thanks to Nick Larandis, who composed our theme. Andrew, if folks want to know more about the show, where should they go?
OverduePodcast.com is our internet website. Up there we have links to Apple and Google and our RSS feed. We're on Spotify. We're on Stitcher. We're on Podbean. We're on all kinds of places where you get podcasts that we get like emails and tweets about, but that we didn't actively sign ourselves up for.
Yeah, that's the part of being on a network, I think, that benefits us. It just goes out there.
You can, it just goes out there. You can find it, whatever. We also have a Patreon project, patreon.com/overduepod. Give us a little bit of money and then we will go buy stuff with it, including equipment and hosting and daycare for my child.
Yep. Those are the things.
Those are the things. March is coming up.
Yep.
It's another month. Here comes March. Craig, what are we reading in March?
Yeah. So before that, we will have a Q&A episode. That's our upcoming bonus episode. If you're listening to this at the on the day it drops, you still have time to email us some questions for our upcoming bonus episode for February. But next month, next week, I'll be talking about Blue Castle by L.M. Montgomery, Lucy Maud Montgomery. Following that, Journey to the Center of the Earth by Jules Verne. Then The Crossover by Kwame Alexander. On a Pale Horse by Piers Anthony. And Ash by Melinda Lowe. It's going to round out our March schedule for you. That's all I got, Andrew. Time to run for president, I guess.
Yep. Look, let me be clear. Time to try to be happy. That's my Obama impression.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.